deceive me, now here's a surprise.
Hello, listeners. This is the second hour of the Out of This World radio program with your host, Ted Marr, broadcasting from the studios of KKNW in Bellevue, Washington, on 1150 AM. The program focuses on out-of-this world information, including psychic phenomena, metaphysics, and predictions for the coming years in Seattle, the United States, and beyond. We will have only the best psychics and astrologers in the world on our program. And today we're very, very fortunate and grateful to have John Hogan from Whidbey Island. John is considered the world's authority on Nostradamus and also other prophetic traditions. He's an accurate futurist and a forecaster in his own right, and he's received wide international recognition in appearing on over 100 television and over 1,000 blog and talk radio shows on five continents, North and South America, Asia, Australia, and Europe. He has also accurately predicted the winner of every presidential election for the last 44 years, and we're very grateful to have him on. John, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Wonderful. Well, wonderful. I'm so glad you could make it on today. How have you been?
Well, I've been good. I've been very busy, as usual, but trying to get a book about prophecies of World War prophets. It's a very rare club of seers that are scattered along the timeline from the 3rd century A.D. all the way to 1945, who were people who had one thing in common. They had a very, very accurate track record in predicting World War One and Two, and they have also, except for one of them, they also have a very chilling track record of saying that there are three world wars, not two.
Mm-hmm.
And that the Third World War, they also share the vision that the Third World War is a world war that no one is anticipating. They all think the danger died with the Cold War and the Soviet Union. But my work over the years has looked at two things in prophecy that are kind of the most dangerous things ahead of us because people think otherwise, because people are in denial. The first theme that is something I've been warning for 25 years is the coming of climate change, global warming. The second most dangerous situation is this Third World War that's clearly defined and predicted that people believe is never going to happen, and it suddenly, with open eyes, they are step right into the catastrophe, unplanned for, unsought. And the thing hinges around a renewed conflict between what Nostradamus, is one of these prophets, calls the brothers of the North, the great brothers of the great kings of the North. And the term used for the North is Aquilon, which is a 16th century version of saying Aquila, the eagle constellation that used to be in classical Roman literature. It used to be the time that marked the coming of winter, when the winds coming from the north-northwest down into ancient Rome, coming from the direction of Aquila, which was rising in the north-northwest horizon, was always the harbinger of winter. And so the concept in Nostradamus's metaphorical picturing, which he often, one has to be a scholar of 16th century metaphors, classical metaphors, because Nostradamus loved to use them, and they are the key to unlocking many of his prophecies. And so basically the kings of the North, so what is directly over the constellation of Aquila, the eagle constellation, are two countries, Russia and America. The thing that is intriguing about this to me is that Russia and America are meant to be friends, but they are halved or divided, Nostradamus describes, by an Arab source. And they then go from 3 years to 7 months to 13 years after that breakup into a full-scale war. The people could used to anticipate that to be the end of the Cold War, but even back in mid-80s, I was writing in my first book, Nostradamus and the Millennium, I put on the record in the book that I thought there was an outside possibility that the Cold War would die with a whimper, not the long-anticipated Armageddon at the end of the 80s, and it did. The other problem is that the Nostradamus uses eagle kings. If they're eagle kings, then one has to say, okay, an eagle must be a symbol of these two kings, these two brothers, nations. Well, that would rule out the Soviet Union, because unless Nostradamus had said the eagle and Mars contended with each other, Mars as a red planet, a red star, then if there was any phrase like that, I would think, oh, he's talking about the Soviet Union, not Russia. But since he's talking about eagle kings, when Soviet Union collapsed in 1991, it was replaced by the Russian Federation, which soon adopted by 1992 for its official state flag a tricolor, a white, blue, and red tricolor with the double-headed eagle of the Tsarist period.
That's right.
Put on its in the middle of its a tricolor field. So the Eagle King's prophecy then is talking not about the past, but the window for this situation of an unexpected war began in 1992. Mm-hmm. And with the worsening situation in the Ukraine, and also the worsening situation in the Arab world, causing a potential dragging in of Russia and America by their proxies in the Middle East, we have a lot of things that I was worried about during the Cold War renewed again. And so it's one of the most dangerous, suddenly new developments that's happening, overtaking history, that prompted me to drop what I was doing with any other books and try to write this book called A New Cold War, The Prophecies of Nostradamus, Stormberger, and Edgar Cayce. And this book, I'm going to release this book in about 2 weeks. And for those people who want to get an expanded version, PDF ebook version of it, it's going to be an ebook. It'll later be published as a printed book through Amazon. But it's first going to come out, and it's going to come out in two editions. One that will not have, for Amazon, this special chapter that only people who donate $12.50 or a little more to HogueProphecy.com will receive as a gift. This book with an added chapter about the four blood moon prophecies of the Bible.
Interesting. Could you explain to my listeners, John, for those who are unfamiliar with the term blood moon, what does that mean?
The blood moons are literally what it means is there's a time in a total lunar eclipse when the sun is passing its rays through the Earth's atmosphere and in a prism that bathes the moon in red, ruddy light. And it's been, because the moon turns red like it's bleeding, people and their superstitions put upon that, oh my God, you know, the moon is turning red, and actually it became an ancient popular prophecy is going all the way back to the 480 BC period with the prophet Joel in the Bible. It was the first to use the moon will turn red as blood and as kind of an apocalyptic prophecy. Jesus later picked that up in his little apocalypse, which was the Sermon on the Mount of Olives, which in a lot of ways is the closest thing to a direct quote from Jesus concerning eschatological end-time prophecy. All the other related predictions are, well, the most famous are St. John the Divine, who wrote the book of Revelation. But that, if you read the book, is a message sent from Jesus through an angel to him. So it's gone through two steps. But in the little apocalypse, it's the closest thing you get to the witnesses of Jesus actually saying it himself. While he was alive, embodied in the Mount of Olives. So he talked about Joel's prophecy. And then St. Peter picked it up, and then finally shows up again in the sixth seal opening, I believe, of the book of Revelation. And it's basically given in biblical Judeo-Christian tradition, the blood moon is a sign of great change and upheaval, although it need not be bad. To give you some ideas, there were some of these blood moons coincide on Jewish holidays, sacred holidays. And this happened around the 1490s, around the time when the Jews were thrown out of Spain by the Torquemada and the Spanish Inquisition. Okay, I'll have to take a pause for a moment. I'll be back in 2 seconds.
All right. All right.
Hang on. Hang in there.
No worries. I'll just give a station break. Listeners, to my dear listeners who are just turning in now, you're listening to Out of This World Radio International with your host, Ted Marr, broadcasting from the studios of KKNW on 1150 on the AM dial here in Bellevue, Washington. I hope you're enjoying this. This is an interview, live interview, with John Hoag. He's considered the world's authority on Nostradamus, and we're talking about his book. Wonderful books he's written, as well as his predictions for this year and the coming decades. John, welcome back. Welcome back.
I prevented another kind of apocalypse, burning rice.
Oh, no. Well, well, it would definitely be a problem if it...
The bloody rice, yes.
Do you need a fire time to get a fire extinguisher, or maybe some water on the stove?
No, the alarm went off to remind me, as I'm kind of an absent-minded professor when I'm in this mode, so it reminded me that I had to take it off the oven, off the stove.
join the club, John. Yeah, I did the same thing. So anyway, well, that's fascinating about the blood moon. But I agree with you. It's interesting that it can be a time of tremendous change, but not necessarily bad change.
Well, And if I could enlarge it a little bit, the blood moons, I won't go into the details. The book will go into a lot of the details. It's become very popular because of John Hagee's book, which ironically was published the day after I published a renewed edition of Nostradamus and the War with Iran, Islamic Prophecies of the Apocalypse, which is also available at Hoag Prophecy and at Amazon or Kobo or Nook tablets. And it's funny that we were both hitting on the biblical thing around within 24 hours of each other. His book was widely popular, but it was widely popularly promoting a kind of the usual Judeo-Christian anticipation. And in my work, and in my work at HoagProphecy.com, I try to look at all prophetic traditions from a more agnostic point of view, a balance, what I would say is a balanced point of view that's aware of what has been promoted as anticipated and interpretation of prophecy, opposed to what maybe it might be if we kind of look beyond the anticipation. I mean, for give you an example, it's not the first time that people anticipate major things going on in their religious evolution. For 1,000 years, Hindus had, Brahmin priests had predicted that the next great avatar or world teacher would come from Bihar, India, and that did indeed happen when Buddha was born.
But they, interesting.
Yes, and they anticipated that Buddha was going to refresh and renew the Brahmatic version of Hinduism, which was a caste system which put the Brahmas as the high priest caste above the lower castes. But then Buddha, when he came into being, he actually said everybody was a Brahmin when they were a meditator, which was complete heresy. And so then they tried to kill him for doing that. And eventually Buddhism was pretty much, within several centuries after Buddha's nearly converted the whole country, India eventually purged most of the dominance of Buddhism right out of India and restored the Brahmanic Hinduist fundamentalist point of view. So a lot of times religions expect their version of things looking backwards into the past is going to be repeated in the future. And with with prophecy, I learned from this point of view of mine is that it's not really that way. It's more people, most people miss what's actually being predicted as something new. So this is what makes my chapter, I think, I hope, refreshing to the usual books that are out there. I mean, now their books are starting to get as numerous as 2012 books, where basically John Hagee is saying these blood moons, which are coming up. We just had one in April. We're going to have another one in September, and then a couple more in 2015. Mm-hmm. He looks at this as meaning it's going to be some kind of showdown between Iran and Israel. It's going to lead to the second coming of Christ. Mm-hmm. And I would just simply close by saying that when you have a tradition in prophetic history that has made more end-of-the-world predictions that have never happened, one has to look at all of what is said by Christian theologians about end times with a grain of salt.
Sure. And that doesn't mean that there's not going to be changes, of course. Things are always in flux. And one of the things I'd love to ask you, John, I know you've studied Nostradamus very, very extensively. One of the things I've heard is that he had predicted way back in the 15th, 16th century that after the 2040s, 2030s, 2040s, that there would eventually be 1,000 years of peace and spiritual development for humanity on this planet. Do you remember that prediction? Do you remember him talking about that, John, or anything indicating that?
A lot of the ways Nostradamus is interpreted depends on the merit of the scholar's knowledge of 16th century French and the other languages that Nostradamus used. And beyond that, also an understanding of how Nostradamus thought, how he gathered his thought processes, what were his biases, his personality issues, his hopes and fears that were rooted in a pre-industrial view of the world. And the other thing that happens is that scholars and writers of Nostradamus also have to take stock of their own thought processes and biases and expectations that are biased towards seeing things through Nostradamus' eyes in the 21st century mindset. I often find a lot of my subtext to my books is to help my readers understand the pitfalls of prediction that are, at the very least, if none of this is true or is true, a more important immediate lesson to learn is how we are so unmindful of our biases when we kind of base things on a given of, well, we base it from this understanding and then move from there, never questioning that our understanding may be completely false. And people go to wars and raise up and take down entire religions and civilizations based on false premises. And so there, as far as I know, there is nothing in Nostradamus that says that by the 2030s and 2040s that we will be in a millennium of peace. What is intriguing, though, is a century six of quatrain 24 talk about something that's related to the Mars-Jupiter conjunctions, which are rather infrequent, that sort of pinpoint a period where there would be, after a calamitous war under Cancer, there would be a new person elected that would bring peace on Earth for a long time. And what is intriguing about that is that the last time that happened, that conjunction, was during about a month after Barack Obama was inaugurated in his first term in office. So the question then is Barack Obama supposed to be, destined to be, someone who will bring peace maybe to the Middle East? Maybe it is kind of interesting that he is putting out peace feelers to Iran right now, after Senator and Secretary of State John Kerry's what I call joke diplomacy, where he basically taunted the Syrians to dismantle all their chemical weapons as a grounds to avoid being bombed to the Stone Age, And they actually took his joke seriously. It was a joke. He didn't mean it, and it wasn't some elaborate way to play bad cop to Obama's good cop, because if Obama was playing good cop, that was a pretty dangerous game he was playing by completely dismantling his credibility with the Arab League, the EU, the British Parliament, and 70% of the American people, plus U.S. Congress, who are all dead set against him striking Syria. And if he had done so, he would be even more isolated and alone than Bush was in invading Iraq. So rather than this being a maneuver to get Putin to help him get Syria in line, it was more Putin throwing a rope to Obama to save him from the greatest foreign policy disaster of his career. So this is basically... not exactly a man so far who's showing himself to be a great peacemaker, let alone an executive and leader, but in foreign affairs. But be that as it may, I don't let my own views block it. It certainly shows that this happened in his time frame. So the opportunity is there for him to bring peace on earth for a long time. Whether he fulfills that option is something that one deals with in the potentials of prophecy with anyone. We all have a potential to be better than we are, but we have programmed into us from birth onwards a predilection to follow our lowest potentials and unconscious habits. And these are the things, the fuel that fuels the predictability of prophecy.
Sure. I have to ask you, John, I've heard this before, and I'm sure you'll have some good thoughts on it for my many listeners. Some people have said this year, 2014, is a parallel to 1914 and 1814, actually, that the century actually begins 14 or 15 years after the turn of each century. And this goes all the way back to the 12th century with the signing of the Magna Carta in England. I'd love your opinion on that, John.
I don't subscribe to the century being off by 14 years, but I do subscribe to the interesting parallel between 1814, which saw the collapse of the Napoleonic Empire when Napoleon abdicated, and then 1914, certainly. The opening to my current predictions on 2014, predictions for 2014, which is available at Amazon, Kobo, and Nook, and also at HogueProphecy.com. I opened the introduction looking at the parallels of wondering, asking the question, will 2014, the centenary anniversary of another war that no one wanted, that everyone worked very hard to prevent, but suddenly, with open eyes, the European imperial empires marched into great catastrophes that I literally called history's water breaking, that gave birth to our very strange century of modern unsettling times, the end of the ancient regimes, some 500 to 1,000 years of European-centered history was, in 4 years after 1914, overthrown. Mm-hmm. And that unleashed a lot of good as well as negative forces into the world that really define our modern times. And I made the argument in predictions for 2014 that 2014 was going to be another year where history's water breaks and would propel us into another paroxysm of evolutionary upheaval and change for a century.
Interesting. Now, one thing, I think you were on my program, John, a couple of months ago, and I remember you talked about how, if I'm not mistaken, how this time period all the way through the end of this year, astrologically speaking, was a time of truth. For people. In other words, things which are true would become truer, self-evident, and things that aren't true would fall apart. And this would apply not only to governments, but also businesses and perhaps personal relationships as well.
Yeah.
I'd love your thoughts on that, John. That was an interesting comment you made some months ago about that.
It's basically astrologically framed in two configurations in the stars. One is the transit of Saturn through Scorpio.
Okay.
Whenever Saturn through Scorpio takes place, it passes over the U.S. ascendant, which in my books I argue it is actually Scorpio rising. That is how we express as a nation ourselves in the world, how we're viewed by the world through what we do or don't do. And when Saturn is in Scorpio, it is conjuring up for karmic review, because Saturn is the reality checker in astrology. They call it the Grim Reaper, but it's only grim to the ego if the ego wants an illusion to survive and be sustained, that Saturn says, hey, I'm going to be Chef Ramsay coming into your kitchen. I'm going to say that it's a mess and you need to clean it up. And so Saturn is basically telling us in the areas of economy, money, inheritance, governance, that systemic sustainability of society, that we have to make major, or at least begin, the road to reforms. It may take 28 years, the whole full cycle of Saturn's orbit back from being in Scorpio to returning into Scorpio around 2042. That if we, especially Americans and Europeans, because of the way Saturn influences the European Union's birth chart and the United States chart, we are tied together, for better or worse, in this renewal of ourselves. What I did in the book 2013-2014, which is also at HogueProphecy.com, which is really a book about the 28 years of Saturn return, I looked at how, in the past, every 28 years, America always has an opportunity to redefine itself. And this has been one of the great virtues and gifts of the American people, how we, when we're beset or we're in a malaise, things happen, and then we redefine ourselves. Like the Civil War was a terrible situation, but it helped forge a new America, and it actually advanced us to westward. And after the war, it unleashed a lot of energy that in another 28 years turned us into a world power. Mm-hmm. And then when we got into the 1920s and the next Saturn return, we actually didn't do anything to fix and change ourselves. We just kind of more of the same. When there were warning signs of systemic problems in economy and finance, we basically let it all go. And then, of course, the next 28 years were a rough ride of the crash of 29, the depressions of the 1930s, and World War II. And that's where Saturn kind of spanks you for, as a nation, for not looking at the karmic, the action-reaction consequences. Good actions get good reactions, bad actions get bad reactions. That's basically what karma means. Mm-hmm. And so we collectively, karmically, suffered and struggled. Of course, then by the time we got in the 50s, we had again an opportunity to redefine ourselves, and Eisenhower's administration did a lot of that and kind of created this, really crystallized our ascent into being a world superpower at that time, and also a beacon for other nations to follow. Then came the period in the Reagan years where we had to redefine ourselves again. And again, we kind of redefined ourselves. With Carter kind of started it when he made his famous misnamed malaise speech. He called it Crisis in American Leadership, where he made basically a prophetic commentary that if we didn't start fundamentally changing how we used oil, how we used fossil fuels and dealt with global warming and other things, that in 30 years' time, we'd really be in trouble.
I remember that. Yeah.
And the response of the American people was to reject it and to adopt Ronald Reagan's view, was that let's drill more, we're great, we don't have to worry about that, kind of, basically exacerbated the economic policies and the fossil fuel addiction that is now leading us to planetary climate change that is threatening all life on the planet.
Well, the other thing, that just springs to mind is that, gasoline prices are approaching $4 a gallon here in the United States. Some places it's higher. And if we get into another shooting match in the Middle East with Iran imploding, you could easily see gas prices easily double.
And also the situation with Greater Syria, which, by the way, I had I had predicted years ago that there would be a breakup of Iraq. Actually, on Coast to Coast AM on the, I think it was the 16th of November show with Ian Punnett, I was asked by Ian Punnett to reiterate stuff I had said on, I think, the day before the 2000 presidential election. I had, written an article, I think it's November 6th, that 2000, many years ago, where I was asked to describe the future according to an Al Gore presidency or a George W. Bush presidency. And at that time, I was saying, because I've been making presidential predictions since 1968, and I'm currently 12-0 in predicting the winner by the popular vote.
I had gone
on shows the day before when I wrote that article and said, you know, this time around I got a funny feeling I'm going to be equally right and wrong. That's the message I'm getting. Al Gore is definitely going to win the presidency by a 500,000 votes, but I'm also equally going to be wrong, and I can't reconcile how one can be right and wrong.
John, pardon me to interrupt, but I've invited Mr. Gore on my program, and if he does come on, let me know what questions you'd like me to ask him.
Okay, that would be interesting. Basically, I looked at his future as a president. I saw him as a single-term president, and I also am glad he didn't, in one way, didn't become president, because I also saw him dying in office in his first term. So, from heart issues, and that's, I'm glad that future didn't happen. However, I also stated that if George Bush was president, that within halfway through his first term, he would there would be some major terrorist action, I said, in his term. And I said halfway through his midterm of his first term, he would get into a major conflict in the Middle East, most likely with Iraq. He would overthrow Saddam Hussein. That would be very easy to do, and then send America into a Vietnam quagmire in Iraq. And I said that 2 years before it happened, and a year or so before 9/11. So,
amazing.
Unfortunately, my track record with Iraq is pretty accurate, and it continues. I'm looking at this new ISIS group, that's the splinter group that split off from Al Qaeda in Syria, and they are basically calling themselves what I said would eventually happen to Iraq after America would lose this war, I also said. And I backed it up with some prophecies of Nostradamus about crusaders entering Mesopotamia, which is the ancient name of Iraq, because Iraq is meso, between two potamia, between two rivers, the Tigris and Euphrates.
We have people listening in Iraq on this program now, by the way.
Yes, well,
yes.
It's, you know that I found out for a time that, and they're probably still receiving Hope Prophecy bulletins, that Ayatollah Ali Sistani's organization used to give me a message saying, we've received your report from HopeProphecy.com. So I was rather honored that the highest Ayatollah of the Shias was actually looking at my stuff, because this man is not very well known to the American media, is because of his practice of quietude, was really the man that kept the lid on the Civil War going completely hot in 2006 or 2008. But it is a stunning thing for me to hear in the last month that he publicly came out and with a message to the Shia sect that's 60% of Iraq, arm yourself and defend Baghdad. Not a man of violence, and for him to actually call the Shia to arms, he never did that before, even during all the long years, 8 years of the Iraqi occupation with the U.S., never did that. It was a Muqtada al-Sadr, who was not an Ayatollah, just a simple cleric, but a, kind of a political strongman, who was the one who was promoting violence. And he is now doing it again, and I've predicted that Baghdad won't fall to ISIS, the greater Syrian army. I basically said that you would see Iraq break up into three parts: Kurdistan, Sumer, which is the Shia part, which would have Baghdad as its capital, because the last civil war effectively ethnically cleansed Baghdad of all of its, nearly all of its Sunni neighborhoods. And then you would have Greater Syria as the Sunni Iraq Shia part. And I'm kind of shaking my head in disbelief when I'm actually seeing it happen before my eyes, because a lot of these things I don't enjoy being right about.
Sure, right. Well, sometimes, yeah. Well, you have to tell people, you know, what you see, and that's what you're doing. I just want to say briefly, for those who are just tuning in, you're listening to Out of This World Radio International. Broadcasting from the studios of KKNW in Bellevue, Washington on 1150 AM. We have on the air a wonderful scholar named Mr. John Hogue. He's considered the world's authority on Nostradamus and other prophetic traditions. Go ahead, John. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Well, it kind of brings us back to an issue of the Cold War prophecies, or World War prophecies of Nostradamus. And he talks about the brothers being undermined by barbare source. The term he uses, barbare. Barbare can mean two things. It can mean literally Barbary, as in the Barbary Coast pirates of Libya. And it kind of denotes a clue, a hint to metaphor for terrorists of his time being used as a metaphor to describe Islamic terrorists of the future. The Barbary corsairs, when Nostradamus was alive in the 1550s writing these prophecies, were noted to be a proxy of the Ottoman Empire, of the Suleiman the Magnificent, who was really on the warpath with Europe at that time. And they were raiding the coast of Nostradamus' lands of Provence, and they were considered hijacking people and taking their ships. And they were the hijackers in planes, only they were in corsair ships, of his day. So I find he uses metaphors that he can understand to try to depict things in the future, and it seems to be describing another set of barbari, maybe even Libya itself, which now has become a breeding ground since another kind of NATO-led attack into a country has given us a new failed ruined state, and now another ground for terrorists to spread across North Africa.
Sure.
But the other thing too is that Barbare is also an anagram, could be an anagram for what in French would be d'Arabe, which is D apostrophe A R A B E, the French spelling for Arab. One has to decipher all of Nostradamus' codes either in Latin, Provençal, or French, with a little Greek put in. I mean, just for all you Nostradamus sleuths out there, please be aware that if you find something that adequately fits into English, it's wrong, because Nostradamus never used English in his prophecies.
Wasn't there an anagram called Mabus or something like that for the Antichrist? I can't remember exactly.
There are three Antichrists in Nostradamus's prophecies, and it's unique in the traditions of prophecy that he's the only prophet in history to ever see three. The first was Paul Ne Laurent, which is, these are three towns in southwest France, but in the prophecy it goes on to describe a person that sounds very much like Napoleon Bonaparte. So Paul Ne Laurent, it must be an anagram, and so it does switch over to Napoleon Roi, Napoleon King. And and in the spelling of Corsican,
amazing.
Napoleone, and Apolloon, which he uses in another prophecy about Napoleon, the angel of destruction, Napoleon Apolloon, it's him making a nasty pun against Napoleon. That's the first. The second is based on the ancient name of the river Ister, or Danube, which is spelled H-I-S-T-E-R.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, Adolf Hitler.
Oh, my goodness. Wow.
Yes, and he's mentioned, Ister is mentioned five times in the prophecy, and they all, when you gather all the quatrains together, it's definitely a future. I mean, it's breathtaking what he had to say about Hitler in World War II. I mean, he basically said he'd be the man of the crooked cross.
Oh, the crooked cross, the swastika, of course.
Which in German is called the Hakenkreuz, crooked cross. Hmm. So he actually called it by that. He also called him the captain of Greater Germany. This is the official title of the Third Reich as a state, was the Grossdeutsches Reich. And so Grossdeutschland is correct. And he said in the same prophecy that there would be unions broken in 37, 40, 41, and 45. And then when you look at that, I mean, he's a little off on the 37, or maybe not. I think the Rhineland was occupied.
It was the Rhineland. Yeah. That's true. Yeah. It was the Rhineland. And, that's when, 37.
Yeah. And then 41, of course, was the breaking of pacts. America broke trade pacts with Japan and started embargoing oil. And and the Japanese broke all the rest of the pacts by invading Pearl Harbor, attacking Pearl Harbor. The Soviets were invaded by Germany, breaking the German-Soviet non-aggression pact. And then finally, the Axis Alliance, the pact of the Nazi allies, was broken in 45 by their destruction at the end of the European theater hostilities of World War II.
That's amazing. Well,
go ahead.
Go ahead, John.
I'm done.
All right, my friend. Well, you have so much interesting to say. This program could easily go on for another 6 or 8 hours with you. But we only got an hour, but we got a lot of time.
I tend to drone on, so.
That's okay. Not to worry. Now, for a possible Third World War and a possible Antichrist, what has he said about that scenario in 10 words or less? Just joking. Up 10 words.
You must be Art Bell.
No, I'm not Art Bell. No.
You're more generous. He only gave me 3 words or less to describe profound things like what was going to happen in the next 1,000 years.
Oh, heck, take 500 words. No worries. 500
words. What was your question again? You want in 10 words or less?
What did Nostradamus write about? I don't think the future is written in stone. I don't think a third world war has to happen, and I don't think a third Antichrist has to happen either. But that's why I'm saying a possible Antichrist, a possible third world war. What did he write about that?
Well, he talks about the third Antichrist being Mabus, and Mabus is M-A-B-U-S. It equates an anagram decoding using specific rules. Nostradamus, I wrote a book after 25 years of studying this. I wrote a book in 2008, which still reads like I wrote it yesterday, called Nostradamus and the Antichrist, codenamed Mabus. It's also available at hogueprophecy.com. And it looks at all the candidates and most of them focus on two kinds of candidates. Potentates and leaders in the Middle East, or American presidents who are fighting potentates and terrorist leaders in the Middle East. In a short period, I can't deconstruct. You can go on nohookprophecy.com and see some of the deconstructions of Mabus into specific names. But the four most important names are Mabus becomes a reverse negative anagram of Saddam. And I'll explain how that's possible, because letters B's can be turned into D's. You can reverse letters as well as reverse, like M-A, like Saddam becomes Madas. Then it goes Mabas if you turn the D over, and then you can erase one redundant A and replace it. You can always replace one redundant letter with the letter that that fits in the puzzle. And completes the puzzle. So Mabus is in a reverse. Then you get Osama bin Laden. Osama, U-S-A-M-A, is M-A-A-U-S. It replaced the one redundant A with a B. You have Mabus. And that is the correct phonetics of the Arabic. We say Osama, and that would be like me saying America. It's just ignorant, and it's not really. It's almost like people go Iraq, Iran, it's Iran, it's Iraq, and I'm sure a lot of Americans will not like to be called Americans. I think they ought to stop calling your Iraqis Iraqis. Whenever an American says that, I said, "Oh, you must be an American if you say Iraq." But so anyway, the correct phonetics is that. So those are your two Middle Eastern candidates. Your third candidate is the former American President George W. Bush. And how that works is, in lowercase, G-W-B-U-S-H, the G and the W can be reversed over 90 degrees in lowercase, and the G becomes an A, the W becomes an M. And that is M-A. B-U-S-H, drop the redundant H, it's no longer needed, and you get Mabus.
So fascinating.
The final candidate, who is now becoming, because of many actions that are going on in the world this day, the primary candidate, even though I didn't say that originally in the first edition of this book, is Barack Obama.
Really?
Obama is the correct pronunciation of his name is Obama with a U.
Okay.
So it's U-B-A-M-A. So there you have M-A-A. B-U.
M-A-A-B-U, true. Oh,
one redundant A is replaced by the missing S, Mabus.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And so because of his actions, I'm actually going to redo the book and reissue it this fall. And I'm going to expand on the idea that I had already written about. Basically, I'm going to expand on what's already in the book about Obama, but now it has much more poignancy in the situation today, because I argued that, you know, we're always mistaking, just like I was talking about how we miss our messiahs because we expect something from the past to be repeated in the future. We do this also when we're looking for the antithesis of the messiah, the Antichrist. We're always looking for some really nasty guy, demonic, devilish fellow who's got a swastika armband and a Charlie Chaplin mustache, and we can look at a bunch of guys in mugshot and go, oh, is it him, the weird one? You know, like that. The Bible, and I think even Nostradamus, I posed an essay, I put it out there that the one to really watch for is not the one that's abjectly evil, but the one, but perhaps a good man who through unconsciousness does evil. Then I talk about this more and more. The evil of good men is actually ignored. It's clear to see the evil of, we'll put it this way, and this might be a little controversial for people. But when there's a victim and a victimizer, we can always go Oprah Winfrey on and be sympathetic to the victim of a victimizer, like a wife batterer or something. But I have a different way of looking at it. If we're going to end the circle of unconscious violence behavior, we have to look equally at the victim and the victimizer as being complicit in creating the dysfunction, the violence. I mean, if people do not live like victims, they cannot be victimized. So it's empowering to the victim to actually say, no, you're just as much at fault for this situation as the man battering you. You have to stop putting yourself in situations where you're battered. And you have to stop listening to people like Oprah Winfrey, who is making you there, you're such a wonderful person for being a victim. No, victimhood is a more subtle way that good people are caught in evil acts, because no one should be a victim of anyone. And if you are being victimized, you kind of have your part in it. And it's only when you look at your part in it that you take the responsibility and then have the power to change it.
True.
So I don't mollycoddle victims. I don't put them down. But I just say, look, you're just half of the equation. And, you know, the man who's violent also has to stop what he's doing. It is wrong what he is doing, but it is also wrong that you're putting your face in the way of his fist.
Well, it's interesting you bring that up, John, because the previous hour I had a New York Times bestselling author named Pam Grouse, very interesting lady. She's written many books about the spiritual virtues about being positive, and she says all life's a choice, just like you said, that people just need to make the right choices about life. And, of course, if they feel victimized, it doesn't do anybody any good to make wrong choices and blame everybody else for your problems. One thing I have to ask you, John, and I'm sure you get this question a lot, who do you, looking toward the elections for president here in a couple of years, who do you look as the Democratic and Republican candidates, or maybe a third-party candidate as well?
Well, I've been over the years, I've been saying on the record that Hillary Clinton has a destiny to be president, and even though she, I also said on the 7th of March, 2007, in an article that people can read, it's on all my articles for the last 20 years are all posted at HogueProphecy.com in the archives so that people can actually look at where I'm accurate and where I'm not. Mm-hmm. But in that article entitled Hillary Clinton's Albatross, I had talked about how for years I was sure that she had a pretty much sure shot at being president in 2008, except for one weak link in this destiny, and that is that she couldn't explain her vote to go to war with Iraq in 2002, because I thought that she was going to end up fighting Obama a year from that time in the primaries,
and he was
going to use the anti-war faction in the progressives and Democrats in a tight race, he could win, and that would end her chance to be president in 2002. I also said that if Obama became president in 2002, he would come to his destiny too soon when he was not ready, and that it's better to come to your destiny too soon than too late. But that doesn't mean, even though you have a better chance of ascending to your potential, it doesn't mean you will have the time or see the opportunities and the maturity to do so. And I'm thinking more and more he has not achieved it, that if he had waited till 2012, like I saw was the right time for him to be president, I think he might have been ready for the job.
And he never, pardon me, John, but he never gave you a call before he started running for office.
No. although people in the White House, I know for a fact, read me. Wish to be unknown, but I'm rather surprised that some of the people who read Hoke Prophecy is their evil pleasure.
And for all we know, they could be listening right now to hearing.
They most likely are.
Probably are.
But I have the unique situation when I'm writing about a situation, I have to be mindful that not only are people in America reading me, but people in ISIS are also reading me.
That's true. And we have our followers in the Middle East.
I have people who read me on all sides of any conflict. And so I'm often mindful of that when I'm writing, that I try to get it fair and straight. Even if I'm going to hit both sides, I'm going to hit it fair and call a spade in either case. Now, the thing is that Hillary Clinton, even though she lost her chance to be president, I kept writing that, you know, I see her as a important team member in Obama's cabinet. I see her as vice president or something as powerful as that. And then she didn't get vice president. I couldn't shake the idea. I even wrote about it. I still can't shake it that something's going to happen. And then she ended up being Secretary of State.
Sure.
Surprised her as much as everybody else.
Sure.
I do see her running for president in 2016. And short of any health issue related to her head, that I know that she's had thrombosis. I just actually discovered that after I made the prediction that she's had, with all those long trips she took around as Secretary of State, she had a blood clot from sitting too long, and that she is prone to that. So she is currently on blood thinners, and that probably has kept it at abeyance. But it is an interesting thing that she is, health issues are there in her future, but if they are not there, if they don't come early, then she will be president of the United States, I believe. And she would have the best chance of being defeated by a man whose stars are actually best for winning in 2016, and that would be Jeb Bush.
Okay. All right.
But I don't know if the shift that is beginning to happen in the Republican Party to bring it back kind of a little more to the center is going to have enough time to achieve that potential for him, because I don't think if the party keeps going towards the extreme right, I don't think any semi-moderate or moderate Republican leader has a Chinaman's chance.
Interesting.
To use that.
Interesting.
Chinaman sure. stands in hell, as they used to say. I know somebody's sure. that's politically incorrect, but
sure, that's all right. That's okay.
So be it.
Well,
how about an American's chance in a Chinese bank?
Right. Right. Well, I like you, John, because you always tell it like it is, and you're not afraid to express
upset.
Your opinion on about things.
Upset
you know,
ruffle some feathers. Yeah.
Well, I don't want you to sugarcoat things. I just want you to tell the truth about what you see. And we have about a minute and a half, 2 minutes left. I want to say just to all of my listeners that I want you to have the last couple of seconds on the program, John. But I just want to tell everyone, thank you so much for tuning in to Out of This World Radio International. We will not be broadcasting on July 4th since it's a holiday here in the United States for Independence Day. But we will be back on the air on July 11th with Susan Liberty Hall, an amazing woman who actually beat cancer, she says, from laughter and being positive. And the second hour of that program will have a wonderful numerologist, one of the best love and relationship counselors on the U.S. West Coast, Deborah Spellfox from here in Seattle. And I just want to thank everyone around the world in the United States, Canada, and Europe, in Asia, South Asia, Australia, New Zealand, South America, and Russia. And Japan for and Africa as well for listening in. And John, we've got a few seconds left. I'd like for you to give the parting words to my audience.
Well, thanks for having me on, and also I would invite everybody to come visit hogueprophecy.com. That's hogueprophecy.com, and check out my books and articles.
All right. Goodbye, everyone. Have a wonderful weekend, and we'll talk to you again in 2 weeks.